I'd like to welcome everybody this evening. This is a continuation of the commentaries on some of the suttas. And the sutta tonight that we're going to be talking about is the Madhupindaka Sutta and the Majjhima Nikaya 18, for those who follow those kinds of numbers, also known as the Honeyball Sutta. And it's a sutta, it's the discourse by the Buddha that expands upon papancha. And for any good, solid, grounded Buddhist, the word papancha will keep coming up again and again and again. And so tonight we're going to explore not only what that word means, but how it has a profound central place in the Buddha's teaching, and hopefully in our own practice. And it's an interesting sutta, partially because some of these suttas reveal in very subtle ways some of the characters of the people who are present, and this certainly does. There's a man named Dandapani, and Dandapani, whose name means golden stick. The Buddha goes in after alms round into his little recluse woods, and Dandapani sort of decides he wants to go in and ask a question. He's a kind of a slick character, stands on one side leaning on his golden cane, has the feeling in the sutta of being a little bit arrogant, and asks this just kind of sort of casual relationship to his question that isn't real serious, I don't think, or the Buddha would have expounded upon it more. And he asked the Buddha, what is your contemplative doctrine? What do you teach? And the Buddha says this: this doctrine, friend, is to keep one from quarreling with anyone in the cosmos, with its deities, Brahmas, Maras, with its contemplatives and priests, its royalties and common folk. The doctrine where perceptions no longer obsess the Brahman who remains dissociated from sensual pleasures, free from perplexity, cut away, devoid from craving, becoming and non-becoming. Such is my doctrine. Such is what I will proclaim. And then the following paragraph talks about what that paragraph had on Dandapani. And it says, he went away, shaking his head, waggling his tongue, raising his eyebrows so that his forehead was wrinkled in three furrows, and left leaning on his stick. So that's... I think the word totally confused would be... And the Buddha then didn't go on and elaborate much. And some of the monks who were close by were listening and were perplexed as well. And so they went back to the Buddha and asked him to expound a little more upon it. And the Buddha said, where perceptions no longer underlie the person, tended by mental proliferation leading to lust, aversion, desire, and conceit. And then he ended and went back inside, I guess, and the monks went, this is too much. I still don't understand it. So maybe we'll find one of the venerable monks that have been around a while to explain this and elaborate more on it. So the monks then go to Mahakachana and ask him, what does this mean? And at that point, Mahakachana begins to expound upon papancha. And so we'll forget all of the Buddha's explanations because we'll probably be waggling our tongue and furrowing our forehead. And we'll go to what Mahakachana has to say, and we'll talk about that. Papancha in Pali is the root word means to spread out. And how that's translated in terms of English is the proliferation of thought, when you sit down and you have every intention to meditate and you drop your attention to your breath, suddenly the thoughts spread out. They don't just allow that kind of central focus, but begin to take you into domains and ranges and times that are very ephemeral to the moment at hand. And this tendency for the mind to elaborate upon, to continually embellish, and to expound on and on and on forever in the direction of time and location and memory and fantasy, is at the heart of the Buddha's teaching, really, in terms of not only anatta, but in also pain and conceit and distortions, all sorts of distortions of mind. For this sutta, in its heart of heart, is the Buddha was addressing how the ending of conflict. And this sense of papancha is at the center of how conflict is formed and how conflict perpetuates itself forever. And so to understand how the mind proliferates out and to form these constant elaborate waves of thinking on top of each other really does allow us to come to very deep understanding of the nature of conflict. So to understand again, papancha, it's interesting. I was with my cat. The cat was on my knees and I was petting it. And as my cat will do from time to time, it just looked up and stared at me in a kind of, wasn't a blank stare, but I felt it was a very rational stare that had a lot of meaning behind the stare. And I filled in the blank of that stare with all kinds of personal references. I wasn't petting him well enough. He wanted to be pet in a different place. He was tired of this. When was I going to feed him? And I began to realize that this stare was really my inward stare, of course, but that was how papancha, it can be induced by contact with anything. I mean, here's a cat that, I'm sorry, but I don't think there was any rational reason for its stare. Maybe there was a spider behind me or something. But my mind filled in everything. And it filled it in with the area of myself that was the weakest in terms of self-doubt. I'm not scratching it right or, something. Or in terms of paranoia, why is this cat staring at me? What's going on here? Does she know something? And you can just see where papancha rests or where it gets its momentum, where it gets its fire and its energy. As soon as things are quiet, that's what is elaborated upon. And so as soon as we are quiet in our meditation, as soon as we make a reference or an effort towards just the stillness of being with our breath, the mind lashes out. It just moves into papancha. It doesn't move into papancha in just that moment. The papanchaizing is continuous, and we don't really even realize that we're floating on these ripples all the time until we try to focus our attention someplace else. If you look at our culture, it is filled with papancha, editorial commentaries. I don't know if you've been watching sports, but I was watching the World Series, and it's like a sports commentary. It's like, well, he's pitching on 3 days rest, and he's not really, his curveball just isn't hitting the way it used to go. I remember seeing him back 20 years ago, and his curveball was much quicker, and they're just killing him out there because he's not getting them on and on and on and on. About what? I mean, it's all just a proliferation of, you know, to fill a fill-in. Why, he's just throwing a ball. He's just throwing a little... So it's that... So getting that sense that papancha is that need that we have to kind of reference everything and to elaborate upon everything, and that sense of proliferation, mental proliferation. I like the word proliferation in particular. It's a little bit like this. We're going through. The commander's voice was like thin ice breaking. He wore his full dress uniform with a heavily braided white cap pulled down rakishly over one gray eye. We can't make it, sir. It's spoiling for a hurricane, if you ask me. I'm not asking you, Lieutenant Berg, said the commander. Throw on the power lights. Rev her up to 8,500. We're going through. The pounding of the cylinders increased. Tapakata, 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 tapakata. The commander stared at the ice forming on the pilot's window. He walked over and twisted a row of complicated dials. Switch on number 8 auxiliary, he shouted. Switch on number 8 auxiliary, repeated Lieutenant Berg. Full strength and three turrets, shouted the commander. Full strength and three turret. The crew bending in their various tasks, hurling 8-engine heavy hydroplane, looking at each other and grin. That old man will get us through, said one of them. The old man ain't afraid of hell. Not so fast. You're driving too fast, said Mrs. Mitty. What are you driving so fast for? said Walter Mitty. He looked at his wife in the seat beside him with shocked astonishment. For those of you who don't recognize Thurber, Walter Mitty is a man who, with the slightest sound, goes off and fills in with enormous fantasies and wish fulfillments to get him out of whatever is kind of miserably there at the moment. And it's usually the sound of tapakata that will send him off into one of these. So in some ways, papancha has a tendency or has an ability to make life more interesting. It makes it a little more enticing. It adds spice to it when our life may seem dull or boring, or some of the other aversive, subtle ways that life can come at us. And especially if we're doing something as innocuous as following the breath, suddenly there is a lot more excitement in the fantasies and the displays of mind. Any references that would take me out of this moment that seems so, I don't know, ordinary. And that's really what papancha, one of the ways papancha is most used. It's to get us out of the ordinary, to get us away from the kind of minor irritations or boredom that follow us all. Why we drive, why we speak, why we walk around, and that kind of typical ordinariness is for us to take papancha and sort of, you know, just take flight out of that ordinary into the realm of wherever we want to go. I mean, the mind is enormously creative in that sense. It can go anywhere. You missed your Hawaiian vacation? Go back. Mark Twain said, the worst things in my life never happened. And it's that, again, it's that sense that given, you know, sort of some leisure time, we will create horror scenes for ourselves as well. If you look how memory is formed and what we remember is what we embellish, not really the event itself. And if we ever go back and have a video of what it is that we've embellished and we actually see what it is that actually happened, we're amazed often by how we've taken it and made it much more or much less than it really was. So this sutta is really about understanding how thoughts create that sense of embellishment, And within that sense of embellishment comes the whole story of me and I and mine. And it's not until that embellishment happens, really, that the full story of I, me, and mine can be played out. But once we start embellishing, we're the central casted character in the story that's being fantasized. Now, the problem is that the fantasy is not real. I mean, that's a minor problem, we might say. But Walter Mitty didn't seem to have that much of a problem. In fact, I enjoy reading his stories. But being Walter Mitty with his wife sitting beside him, and actually their relationship was a little strained, and constantly taking flight like that and not having the ability or the resolve or the willingness to come back and embody his somewhat distasteful life, really is an example of how we all are at times in our own life, are we not? We think of meditation somehow often as a journey that will take us into some kind of fantasy trip, some sort of spiritual embellished world in which there will be an interplay of the fantastic, of the extraordinary. And we really are aversive in many ways to being just who we are, and we create another spiritual set of principles in which we think, well, we'll be moving or evolving into this person that is more exciting, more enticing, has more ethics, more something than what I have. And so oftentimes our spiritual journey can be an attempt to sort of disembody ourselves and to evolve into something much more exciting and much more interesting than who we take ourselves to be. And yet Buddhist meditation is just the opposite of that. It's coming right back into the seat from which we would like to depart, and holding that seat, taking that seat, firming that seat up, and dealing with the ordinariness, dealing with the boredom, dealing with the sense of lack of interest, of just apathy or lethargy of spirit. And to take that seat and to embody the problems of our life, to look head on into the resistances we have into life, requires, I feel, maturity, a great deal of maturity in each one of us. No question about it. We would much rather play in the realm of fantasy and memory. Much rather. And so what happens in Papancha is that when there is some troubling event or circumstance or mood that we might be having, and the thoughts come up and they'll start reacting to that mood, and they start being moved by that mood, and the whole sense of the mood then takes us out into an explanation of why we're feeling the way we're feeling, and then we are either in flight, in fantasy, to get away from that, or we're finding some way to justify what we're feeling by pointing fingers and blaming. And we don't even realize that the papancha is being driven by emotions, for the most part, being driven by the subtle feelings that we might have in relationship to being ordinary, to being uninteresting in this moment, to having a life that is or can be perceived to be just a lack of just kind of dull. It doesn't take very many decades of life before we realize that the hopes and dreams of youth, for the most part, don't become fulfilled. And there can be kind of an implosion of spirit at that point, in which we take flight from what it is that we now realize we have to be. And sometimes that leads to a kind of just a sort of deadness of spirit. Other times it leads to a kind of depression or sadness or despairing. And all of this is being generated because we are unable or unwilling just to hold that ordinariness. And the thoughts keep moving out and remembering the hopes and wishes, the idealisms, And we do this all the time. I mean, it's not just when we were young, but we hold that whole sense of fantasizing when we meet somebody and what their expectations of me are compared to what the expectations of myself are, and have this running commentary within us, often self-critical commentary. It's just papancha moving out from the sense of mood and emotion of ordinaries, moving out of just meanness, out constantly proliferating into more and more sense of self-agony. And the problem with fantasies is that it has no context. It has no boundary. It just keeps going. It has no reference. Once we have escaped from this moment, and may I say it's only in this moment that life is workable. We think life is workable in our fantasies, but it's completely unworkable there because there are no boundaries to it. There's no reference back at all. And if you have no reference back to what it is, and the fantasies create an ever-increasing conflict over and above what the ordinariness is showing, then the mind just tries to escape further in fantasies because the pain of the ordinariness is being exaggerated by the fantasy. By what I really want compared to what is, I just keep creating another layer of fantasy on top of that. And those fantasies aren't like Walter Mitty, perhaps. We internalize them in terms of what I should be, what I must be, and the absolute words of must or have to are indications of that kind of flight into fantasy. Many of us have had experience of circular thinking where we have a problem in front of us and we have no way out of that problem. It's as if the carousel of the problem keeps rotating itself over and over again. We keep thinking the same thoughts. We keep trying to work out the same mental solutions. We keep trying to create the papancha, the noise of for the solution. When what we don't realize is that often circular thinking is being driven by an emotion. And because the emotion is the last place we want to go, we think the solution can be created from the thought. So we go out and try to get more and more creative in our thinking when the emotion is what is driving the thinking to begin with. And the thoughts keep us protected from feeling the emotion, but it's the emotion is where the solution of the problem really is located. Insane thinking. Instead of just seeing what we see and dealing with what we see, both internally, emotionally, and physically, right in our environment, we create whole stories about the problem at hand. You know, there's even a word for it in Vipassana tradition. It's called yogi mind. You give somebody a quiet environment in which they're just there with their minds, and you give them a few days on retreat, and you will find problems exaggerated and dramatic that you never knew existed. I can remember as a monk, I had more problems as a monk than I ever had. I mean, I would eat something like beets, you know, in Thai, and it would make my urine turn red, and suddenly I had urinary cancer and was trying to find a decent Thai hospice to call. That's where the mind, you know, when the mind is just given nothing to do, it takes flight. I remember one time I was in this little hut and there was an ant and it started crawling. I said, oh my God, ants are infiltrating my, well, there's one ant. And I got outside and put oil rags around where the huts are up on these stilts, and because one ant. But I had my mind just created this. I was living on an anthill, and it goes on and on and on like that, like forever, until finally the beauty of that environment is that it starts giving you a sense of what you live with. Most of us are so busy in our life that we don't have the ability to see what we live with, because we're moving on to the next event. But on retreat, when you're quiet, you go through a couple of those things and go, my God, what am I doing to myself here? Is this how I live? And it gives you a foot up into the way Papancha controls us over and over again into insane thinking. I mean, you have a problem, and it doesn't stay just what it is. I'm having a divorce, separating with my boyfriend, my girlfriend. That's the fact. That's sane, objective thought. But what Papancha does is take the feeling of that disappointment and then moves the disappointment into tragedy. I'll never find anyone else again. This is the worst thing that could ever happen to me. I'll be destitute, lonely. I can see myself now, 75. Insane thinking. Here's what Samuel Clemens, and I call him Samuel Clemens this time instead of Mark Twain, because this is a different Sam. This is a different Samuel Clemens. This is what he wrote after he'd had a series of personal tragedies. I think he'd lost a couple of children and perhaps his wife died. There is nothing. There is no God and no universe. There is only empty space. And in it, a lost and homeless and wandering and companionless and indestructible thought. And I am that thought. And God in the universe and time and life and death and joy and sorrow and pain, only a grotesque and brutal dream evolved from the frantic imagination and that insane thought. Sometimes it takes that kind of tragedy to show us what it is that we've lived with our whole life. So when circular thinking arises, for us to be able to go to that sense of pain, that sense of emotional disturbance behind where the thoughts may be taking us, behind the proliferation, behind the need to elaborate and expound into the actual emotional unit itself. Because what the thoughts are supposed to do is to protect us from that pain. They move out. You drop a stone in the middle of a still lake, that's the emotional pain, the hitting of that stone in the lake. The ripples of the thought that move out are moving away from that center point from which a rock fell as a way to move out. Not by fact, but by fantasy, by flight. Because, in fact, it can't move away from the pain. The pain is the reality. What the thoughts do in their concentric circles outward is to attempt to move out in abstraction. And what we begin to realize is that there is no end to that. And the farther out they go, the more entangled and the more treacherous they become, because they have no governance. There's no way to bring them back except by dealing with that stone's actual moment of plummeting in, that actual moment of emotional pain itself. So we come back to that. Okay, ordinariness. Yes, I'm feeling whatever my ordinariness is manifesting in this moment. Okay, I'm feeling that. Fair enough. But does that have to give rise to a whole series of fantasies which will take me out of that? Can I keep bringing myself back, okay, and just deal with the rather unpleasant situation at hand? So how does Papancha work? I'd like to go into the Buddhist, in the sutta, Mahakachana talks about how the actual movement of Papancha works. And it starts, the series of events that occur very quickly are contact, feeling, perception, thinking, and then papancha. So let's just look at that. And as I mentioned, contact can come from any... Contact is just the sense door and the ear and sound, sight and the eye. It's the moment of contact, of seeing or smelling, tasting, whatever it might be, whatever door it might arise on. For Walter Mitty, it was sound. So that moment of contact leads and always has a feeling tone associated with it. And in Buddhism, that feeling tone is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, which means it doesn't really have a pleasant or unpleasant tone. If you look at the tiles in the roof here, for most of us, that's a neutral color, a neutral experience. And so what happens in neutrality is that we bypass it. We don't really notice it. It doesn't catch us. If you look at the carpet, for instance, maybe that is a little more of a pleasant quality to it, and so you'll notice the quality of the carpet. If it's an aversive quality, perhaps some of the, I don't know, other things around the room, then you'll also notice that, but an aversion to that. So the feeling tones are very important because the feeling tones give birth that in the with a perception. In this particular, I'm not trying to get too technical, but I think this is an important sequence to understand. Perception is memory and recognition. So there's contact, there's a feeling, and from the feeling tone is the recognition and memory of that event and how I used to be with that event. And so at the point of perception, recognition, and memory, there's an elaborative response in the mind to bring forth in its filing cabinet of memories similar experiences, similar ways I've acted, similar ways I've been able to avoid or I've been able to handle this particular situation. And so I bring forth a whole system of thought to deal with this particular situation, given this perception, given this feeling tone, given this contact. And of course, I don't just stop with that history. I continue to embellish the history all along the way. And so it just keeps going on, perception after perception after perception. In fact, virtually every perception we have, if you just look around the room, contains a whole file you have on that particular perception. Well, I know that person, or I don't know that person, but I'd like to know that person, or I wouldn't like to know that person. But that person I know, and I don't want to sit by them, or I would like to sit by them. On and on it goes. So what is it that's happening there? There's contact, there's feeling. Just in the moment, look at something and see if there's a feeling tone with it. Feeling of just contained within that very contact, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or kind of neither one. And you can see the higher, the more elaborate the response or the intensity of the feeling, the greater will be the embellishment on that feeling. If it's pain, I've got pain. Oh, God. Get me out of this pain. Oh, this is the same pain that I had. Oh, I remember this. This is terrible. This reminds me of when I was, on it goes. Each layer of ripple, remembering, increasing the intensity. The very thought itself, the very feeling itself gets intensified through the papancha. Because it's not just the feeling anymore. It's the feeling in which I was all. And when I had that happen, in which... And then the emotional pain, and this is where emotion comes in, the emotional pain from those feelings get tied into that particular contact. And now it's like, oh, my history has, I've just been trapped. My whole life has just been miserable. On and on. The sense of I, and this is, in this sutta, it's really an expounding, a very profound expounding upon anatta. To show us how anatta becomes embedded and bred within this proliferation of thinking. Because it's within the thought that our story comes in. And we only know ourselves by our story. And so we constantly look out to sort of certify ourselves. to get the stamp of approval from what is our contact, that we that our story is true and that we are validated through our story, through our contacts. So we look out to elaborate. We have an intentionality to know things and elaborate upon them, because that makes me feel grounded in myself, knowing myself through my story. That is just wave after wave of thinking. So here's what the Buddha said. Here's another. It isn't in the same sutta, but it has so much relevance to this sutta that he was talking to Ananda. Insofar only, Ananda, this is very clear, doesn't need to go through another venerable. Another monk doesn't need to translate this. Insofar only, Ananda, can one be born or grow old or die or pass away or reappear. Insofar only is there any pathway for verbal expression. Insofar only is there any pathway for terminology. Insofar only is there any pathway for designation. Insofar only is there any sphere of knowledge. Only thus can the rounds be kept going when there is any designation of the conditions of this existence. That's how absolute it is. I love that. Because now we're on holy ground. Now we see the problem. Oh, and the problem is terrific. It's horrendous. Yes. So what are we going to do? Expound upon it? Elaborate? Proliferate? Or be quiet? Or be quiet with the problem? Because once the problem is seen, let me read what the Buddha said in the Dhammapada. By seeing the faults as the faults and the real as the real, one lives in perfectly real conditions. When you see the faults, oh God, my mind just keeps... And we see it. We sit down, we focus in on our breath. What do we think that is that's doing that? When we see that move out again and again, and we begin to... What is that? The cat's not staring. What is that? The cat's just staring. That's what's happening. The cat is staring. Everything else is extra. Sometimes I give the hardest... I didn't think it was so hard until I found out that almost no one can do it. Then I realized how hard it was. It was a simple exercise. I thought it was simple. Where you go and you look at the mirror. And for 5 minutes, you just look at yourself in the mirror. And that everything you bring to that reflection is papancha. And you let all of that go. And you just hold the image of the mirror and let the papancha go. And almost no one can do it. Because we're so tied into reconfirming the picture. Reconfirming the image. Validating the image. See, now we begin to understand when the Buddha was talking earlier in this sutta, when he said, perceptions no longer underlie the person. Because that's papancha. That's feeling, story, perception. So now, can we be still? Because that's what the Buddha is always pointing towards. Always. He says he only points in one direction. One direction. Towards liberation. Towards stillness. Towards non-craving. Towards just being. And not proliferating. Not elaborating. Just being. Just being still. Things are what they are. That's all they are. There's no need to do anything to anything. There's no need to expound at all. And everything is held within that single stillness. All the complications, all the sense of incompleteness. It's just the story. The story is never complete. The story always wants more to be added to it, because the nature of the story is that it's embedded in pain of incompletion. And so what it tries to do is to create more story for a sense of completion, rather than resting in the pain of incompletion. Just holding that. I can feel that. Instead of letting that be driven into greater and greater storyline, can we just be still? And allow the story to have a happy ending for the first time. Can we sit for a minute or two?